April 7th, Tangerine SDR. I do two of these a week, so I get confused. So this week, I've been doing a little programming, and we've been getting used to being even more confined in our house. So that seems to be the norm around different places. So interesting little programming projects, but no one unified one yet. So next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave. User joined your
channel. Hello, everyone. I'm playing with a new headset here on a computer I haven't been able to use any audio with for about a year and a half. And hopefully it's clear and understandable. I haven't done any great miraculous things. I've been trying to get to do some code, but there are amazing number of distractions even without leaving the house. But that's life. So otherwise things are going along, just hanging out. I guess that's it. Over to you, Dave.
I do want to mention Dave's being modest. He did send off the board designs to Scotty this week, and he did send a bundle to Homan. So we'll hear about that. So he's been making progress. Next on the list, we have Dave, David N1HAC. Go ahead, David.
Good evening, everyone. And nothing to report on my end, except I'm looking forward to playing with the magnetometers when the board becomes available. I did order one of the magnetometers, so that be ready to do that. Also, interested in what John's doing with the timing system. Yes, so thought I'd get in here and listen as to where things are at.
Well, fine business, Dave. And next on the list is Homan, KD2MCR. Go ahead.
Hello, good evening. This is Homan Ken. So yeah, just like Dave mentioned, I just received a package from him with the magnetometer that he developed. I haven't really tried to fiddle with it yet, since things are really going crazy these days because of the new transition to the online system, everything. So yeah, my plan is to fiddle with that magnetometer and then try to sort of test it. But given the very limited resource that I have right now, I'm living in an apartment, and not having access to any labs or other places where I can possibly test the magnetometer. So I'll have to see what I can do, given what I have right now. Otherwise, there's nothing to report. May I propose that we talk about this magnetometer a little bit earlier time, because I have to step out in about 15 minutes or so. So would that be okay? Over.
Well, I think that's fine. If you can wait till the end of the roll call, then that should be the first topic. Is that okay?
Fine by me. Thank you.
Next on the list, we have Mike, AAAK, shown as recording and Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Then we have Nathaniel, N2NAF. Sorry. W2NAF. Sorry, Nathaniel.
Good evening, Dave. No worries. Good to hear from you. Everything's going fine here in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I, like so many other people, are doing remote teaching. I think it's going okay. Hopefully, Scotty's going to be doing a guest lecture for me in a couple weeks or so. I've been doing a lot of math sort of stuff with our communication systems classes, looking at different modulation schemes. And so I'm hoping Scotty can do a guest lecture talking a little bit about FPGA architecture and how you might actually implement and realize some of these things in an actual system. Let's see. The other thing we're working on getting our postdoc on board. It looks like they won't be joining us in Scranton right away. It looks like we're going to have them work from Boston College for a couple months. So they'll be working on the project, but just through Boston College because of we just can't get them transitioned here with the whole coronavirus thing. So they'll be working on the project from there for a couple months, and then we'll bring them over to Scranton after that. But yeah, we're working on trying to get that going so we can have some develop some real ionospheric sounding applications for the Tangerine SDR. And yeah, I guess I'd like to talk to Scotty later again to just kind of figure out where we are in terms of getting prototypes for the radio system to hear about that again. Okay, W2NF back to net.
Very good. Next on the list, we have Orville in 8WQ. Go ahead, Orville.
Yeah, hi, Dave. Good evening, everybody. I wasn't able to attend last week. I got sidetracked on some kind of project. I forget what it was. But anyhow, it's good to hear all you guys on tonight. I hope everybody's safe. Just a little while ago, I was outside with my wife. We got us a brand new barbecue pit, and we were doing a test run on it. And while I was outside, I figured out quickly that I need to do some antenna adjustments here at my QTH. I got to get my GR5V up higher, and I'm going to go ahead and reinstall a vertical I have. But other than that, that's all that's going on here.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Rob, AI6VN. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, hello, group. I'm only an occasional visitor, attendee, but always interested in your work and looking forward to the SDR. As you, I'm sure, have heard before, my primary function is or focus has been on software and whisper decoding, my Whisper Daemon program. What's probably relevant about what I'm working on is most of the last few weeks we've been working on database to record not only our own, but the spots from all of them. So we've gained some real insights into scaling up and are doing quite well. And I think that will be getting a large and easily searchable database, I think, would be something relevant to the group. So we have some very good results, and I can talk about it to anybody who's interested. But over and all, that's over and out.
Thank you. And next on the list, we have Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Good evening, Dave. Good evening to everyone in the group. Not much activity on the receiver this week. Scotty has a little bit of homework, I think, to work with the layout guy and get back annotated schematics and all that, and then we'll start on the documentation. A few emails with John Ackerman regarding the clock module, and John seems to be making some pretty good progress in terms of his experiments, and hopefully he'll be able to report something here in a while. I don't think he started any actual board work, but he's testing the parts, and his results look pretty good. Back to the group.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Well, all right. Thanks, Dave. And thanks again for doing the yeoman work on keeping us alive here, keeping us all in line. Yeah, it's been kind of a distracting week here, too. You think when you spend more time at home, you get more done. But it seems like you spend more time at home, there's distractions. But mainly I'm trying to get my home office set up. It's piled up with junk and not usable, but I'm just about there. And so I did get some work done on the magnetometer. Thanks, Dave, for sending me that info. We're going to try to do is do a prototype production run. So I know we don't want to really run out of the gate and build 100 of these, but we maybe build 5 of them. And if I could send one to you and to Hillman and maybe a couple others, have them test them. And before we pull the trigger and build like 50 boards, that would be the way to go, I think. And winding down, we've got 3 other projects going on. I'm winding them down. And pretty much this week, I'm going to be wound up with those. And it's going to be Tangerine all the way. So look forward to some hefty progress in the next few weeks. Back over to you, Dave.
Fine business. And next on the list is Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, thanks, Dave, and good evening to you and good evening to the net. Been making some progress here, working on a package, adding in a package called Digital Metadata. It's a companion package to Digital RF, that is the MIT Haystack package that we use to collect data in the ring buffer functionality, and it allows you to store metadata either one-off or at a regular rate, and so I'm going to use it to basically store the channel layout. Each time we collect ring buffer data, the digital metadata will be used to store the list of channels, and for each channel, the center frequency and whatever other information, as well as magnetometer information. I have a couple of things to talk with Scotty about during the open discussion. I've discovered a few things that we're going to need to do, at least for this phase, in order to live within the limitations and capabilities of digital RF for the ring buffer function in terms of the the data rate and some other things. But we can talk about that during the during our open discussion. Also, struggling a little bit with trying to get the digital RF, not so much digital RF, but digital metadata to run under Python version version 3. As some of you may know, I'm using Flask, which the strong suggestion is you do everything under Python version 3 because a lot of stuff is being phased out with Python version 2. It's been somewhat of a difficult matter trying to get digital RF and digital metadata to install under Python 3. So I have contacted a colleague by the name of Ryan Voltz, who works with Phil Erickson, and he's given me a few suggestions that just arrived in my mailbox within 20 minutes ago, so I haven't had a chance to test them, but I'm pretty confident that with his help we'll get that running. So anyway, we'll come back in once we get into the general discussion. And oh, this is cool, I just worked a new one on 40 meters, Kuwait. Anyway, so Fox Tango was great, isn't it? Fox Tango 8. Anyway, back to net, back to you, Dave, AB4EJ.
Congratulations, Bill. Next on the list, we have Dan, N4XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave, and hello, everyone. Not a lot to report. Kind of been on the lookout for new single-board computers since the Raspberry Pi 4 was released some months ago. It looks like there is coming on the scene a new round of single-board computers, and some of them look very interesting. They are using CPUs which are a little bit more powerful than the last round of SBCs, and could be quite interesting for us. Anyway, back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business, and that brings us to the end of the list, and we have a call from Homan to start a magnetometer discussion right away. So anybody wanting to jump in on that, go ahead.
So, Hillman, what did you have in mind? What should we talk about?
So, not fully knowing how the system, the hardware is made and how the system is working, I don't really have anything to really say at this moment. But we talked about the possibility that we will build like 50 sets of magnetometer. I thought that was like mass production, but I don't know. This is just my humble opinion. Would that be okay to build 50 sets without really doing any sort of sufficient benchtop testing? So that's my one first question. And my concern is that at this moment, I do not have any access to lab facility where we could possibly do some, you know, some proper testing just to be sure that the magnetometer is working properly as designed. For example, we have a shielding material where we can put a sensor inside so we can zero the field. to make sure that zero output from the magnetometer is really zero. That would be the one of the basic steps to make sure that the magnetometer is working properly. And also with that, we can also make sure that the noise is not coming from the electronic signal. So those type of things that are the stuff that I wanted to do, but unfortunately, because of this situation, I do not have any access to this. So I want to ask you guys how you feel about just building 50 sets of magnetometer without doing this type of basic preliminary testing.
Well, before you go down the road of building 50, let me clarify what the way I'd like it to work, and then we can decide if that's going to be the right way or whether you should do it a different way. The idea is that typically when you, especially with a board this small, we go to production, we're going to run into minimum board lot sizes. And so what we'll likely do is we'll buy 50 blank boards, but we'll only build up some number of them, like 5 of them or 10 of them, that the quantity that we need to do the testing and to make sure that, like you said, you put it in a shielded box, make sure you can zero out the fields, make sure that the boards are working the way we think they should be. And of course, the very good news here is that the main part of the board is pluggable. So you buy a module from the magnetometer company, and if our board is not right, then you just unplug that and then you wait for the next revision and you plug it into the new revision. So I think maybe I was misunderstood a little wanting to run off and do 50 boards. But so the question I put to you is, how many can we use? So how many should we build? Because I don't want to be starved for boards. I want to make sure everybody who wants one, who can actually do something with it and give us data back and give us feedback, will be able to get one. So what do you think?
Scotty, I kind of need some clarification on what exactly you're talking about. I missed part of the conversation the other day. I believe I have sent you the material relating to the little board, the schematic and so forth for the non-extender version of the support board. Correct me if I'm wrong, and I do think I didn't even send you the bomb on it that I have. If I've sent you the full one, I don't know which one you're talking about here. It makes a difference because I have quite a few of the little ones already, a number of them already put together.
Well, and I want Dave to clarify that he gave Homan he has 4 total of the extender boards. Dave uses 2, and Homan has the other 2.
Correct.
Right. So
I've got 2 boards that you guys built, and one board actually has the magnetometer test, and the other one does not. So I have 2 board that you built and one sensor board that you guys purchased. So
that's the extender version, and I don't know if that's what Scotty's talking about at this point, because I didn't think I had sent him all the materials related to that version.
Yeah, you sent me older versions of that, and I wanted to ask you if you could send me the latest and greatest, because my intent here is to build a single PC board layout that will serve for all 3 boards: remote board, the local board, and the standalone board. And the standalone board will be a depopulated version. It won't be as cool as yours because it's going to be bigger, because it's going to have other parts on it. But the idea is, I don't want to preclude the functionality that you've already proven out on your single board, on your standalone board. So that's kind of where I'm coming from, but I want to make it a production-ready board.
That's too bad. That's not what I was expecting. I will send you the rest of the materials, but I don't understand, really, after thinking about it and working with them, I don't get the economics of the of doing them all in one layout.
Well, because it's just one board layout and one board purchase, and then we can build whatever we want out of it. I mean, you'd be right. It may end up not being worthwhile having two separate board layouts. But I guess, that's what I had in mind from the beginning. But if that's not what we want to do, then we can do two board layouts. I'm not really averse to that.
Well, I do know that in my process of building the prototypes, when I reduced the size from the full extended version to just a small, simple one for people who didn't want scientific grade stuff, but wanted to play with them, it really lowered my overall cost. Not the parts cost, but even just making the boards. They were about $5 or something, I think.
Yeah, what I think is going to happen is when you start making quantities of boards, like, you know, hundreds to 500s, the cost between making a single board, little bitty one, and a dual purpose, a little bit larger one, is going to be virtually insignificant. And that's what we get for paying a layout guy to crunch it all down, because the guy does stuff that you and I, you know, normal people can't do, because he does it every day. So that's, I thought I'd give him a shot at it anyway and see how it would work. And I'm going to run everything by you anyway, because you're the expert. So I want to make sure that whatever we produce looks good to you, because you've got all the experience there, and it's really your design that we're kind of modifying.
Well, I'm concerned about, you know, some simple things like mounting holes, people being able to physically mount it securely. I don't know what your thinking is on that. And also markings on the board. There weren't many on what I sent you, but there are a lot more on the later version, or the full version, helping to indicate which way to put the magnetometer module onto the board and this and that like that. I guess that's where my thinking is.
Yeah, and definitely we want to do that, because you want to make it easy for the pluggable. Make sure you don't plug it in the wrong way, because that would not be good. And so more silkscreen markers would be good, but that's what we're going to try to do. And then we want your input as to whether we succeeded or not.
Okay, well, for the small one, I just didn't see a lot of need to redo it too much, unless there was some electronic error. But who knows?
Well, I'm not going to focus on the small one, because you seem to have that going. But if I could make the larger board do dual duty as a standalone for basically nothing, I don't see what the problem would be with that.
No, I don't have any problem with that, and it will definitely do that. And I will have that stuff to you tomorrow. I wasn't ever absolutely sure you were able to grab it, use the links I sent, but I guess I didn't get any negative feedback, so I just assumed that it worked.
Yep, and it did. I got everything. And although I did, like you said, I don't think you sent me the bomb, because I was trying to make sure I get the right part numbers for the connectors that you used.
Right, and I just forgot to stick it in there. I needed to refresh it, but I wanted to get it off to you quickly. I've tried to keep that. I'm not one of the best at that kind of detail, but I was trying hard to keep that up to date. So I'll send that all to you.
I don't think any of us are the best at any one thing, but you got the board done and you got it out working. That's an accomplishment you should be proud of.
I must comment, I've been running the small board for 2 weeks, and while I still don't know if the numbers are correct, it's been reliable on a Raspberry Pi 3. No crashes or anything.
So that's a question I have for Yeoman. If you had mentioned a shielded box that we could put the thing in and see if we can get the readings down to zero in all three axes, what kind of box do we need? How can we just put it in a steel box, or what kind of shielding do we need other than electrical shielding?
No, the shielding is only for testing, just to be sure that where to test where the noise is coming from, or the zero from the magnetometer reading is really zero or not. for actual installation, yeah, we don't need that kind of shielding. Of course, we can use some basic shielding just to knock out some high frequency noise sources, like some kind of box that has, you know, non-magnetized material like copper would be ideal, or aluminum. But since we're actually measuring really low frequency, almost close to DC magnetic field, shielding is almost impossible. So, you know, if you want to shield like crazy, then probably the thickness of the copper or aluminum should be like, you know, a couple of inches, which is not feasible at all. So the shielding material for noise testing is actually like really, really high mu, high permeability material to observe all the magnetic field around, so you can actually have zero field inside. But that's not what we want to do for actual installation. So for actual installation, I don't know, because this is a new type of magnetometer which has never been used for this type of application. So I think we have to see how that goes. But from top of my head, I can think of like maybe a basic like housing, maybe a copper, aluminum, maybe pipe, you know, pipe. I don't know how thick, maybe a couple of millimeter thickness pipe or something like that, so that we can at least like reduce some high frequency noise around. But it depends on the environment around. Like if you are putting an magnetometer in the, you know, in the middle of nowhere, then you don't have to worry about the kind of shielding. But if you have some noise source around, then yeah, maybe some kind of pipe would be helpful. Shielding material, maybe we can postpone it until we have access to lapacy. So I don't know if that makes is that clear to you guys.
Scotty, the shielding he's talking about for testing is a pretty different animal than you're probably thinking of. It's usually like three or four concentric tubes of mu metal or some very high, high permittivity but low, I don't know. Anyway, it's three or four concentric cylinders that are placed inside each other. It's not at all like electrical shielding. On the other hand, I've been working with PVC for as a mechanism to hold this thing, and I have a lot of things like fairly pure copper and stuff, like thin copper sheeting that could easily be used as an electrical shield on that sort of an arrangement, or some paint on coatings of various sorts that are highly saturated with powdered copper. I have nickel, I have a bunch of different things, so silver. So there are a lot of things we could try.
If I could offer a few observations. First, nickel is a no-no, just as steel is. Nickel is magnetic. Copper is diamagnetic. It actually opposes the magnetic field, and likewise would not be a great shielding material if there's any quantity of it. Aluminum is a good shield.
Well, since we're measuring like close to DC, copper would be okay, I think, as long as the thickness is too big that it actually shields everything. So I think like maybe copper pipe would be okay. Well, maybe I'm wrong, but that was my experience.
Well, wouldn't copper work as a test for your zero values?
No, afraid it won't.
No,
copper and aluminum won't work.
Hold on a second. Before we go down the rat hole here, all of this discussion totally missed the question that I asked, because Dave touched on it. How can we magnetically shield it to get zero readings as a test? That is all I wanted to do, because that way you can put it in there, you can read it, you can say, oh, look, I got zero. I pulled it out, I read it, I got non-zero. So this is just a test. But it sounds like when Dave, KDZREG is telling us that it's probably going to be more complicated than we're going to want to deal with to get the readings down to zero. Is that right?
I'm just saying that Hillman probably has access, at least normally, to the right type of shielding. But most of the things you're thinking of using probably aren't quite the right thing. We can experiment with lots of things, but I suspect that I'm kind of the opinion that plain PVC pipe may be ideal.
Well, what I'd like to suggest here is that not to worry too much about, like, you know, testing it with shielding, all this like fancy material. Right now, I just want to make sure that. So first of all, since I don't really know too much about the hardware itself, as long as we get like correct number from the sensor, then probably it's reading properly. What I like to test first is to, you know, set that magnetometer somewhere outside where there's no really big noise going around. Then we can compare that data set with some other data that we already know. For example, like, that's why I was planning to install it at Genijump, where we have a science magnetometer, full-blown magnetometer, so we can compare back to back. But right now, we don't have that access to that laboratory. Right? Before actually jumping into that kind of like fancy shielding testing, I like to make sure that the magnetometer's readings are reasonable. For example, you can check the value around your place from a website called IGRF, International Geographic Reference Field. You enter your location, geographical location, and you will get sort of expected value of magnetic field around your place. Then look at the number and compare that value to what you see from the magnetometer reading. If the numbers are similar or close, then, you know, we can move on to next step where we can test whether zero is really zero or not. That kind of like testing has to be done after we make sure that the readings are properly, we are getting proper values out of the magnetometer.
Well, my main concern is just getting enough units so that we can do the testing, because I think this is very good that we are going to have to test with different materials. And sorry, David, I keep cutting you off. Go ahead.
I wanted to say a couple of things. One is the only way to magnetically shield it passive way is the mu metal, layers of mu metal, just as a use on CRTs and such. The other way, and you can both know the field and calibrate the magnetometer, is with Helmholtz coils, which some of us actually have access to those.
And what are those again?
That is a set of three-axis coils that are set up so that you can actually get a very well-controlled field at the center of them. And so you can know the Earth's magnetic field, and then you can actually, by measuring the current and knowing the calibration of the system of coils, get a very accurate calibration on the magnetometer.
So yeah, David is completely right that we have to use magnetic field shielding case, which is new metal, which I have in my lab, although I don't have access to that lab right now. And the other thing is that, yeah, just like you mentioned, Helmholtz coil, you can find a line, you can maybe purchase it. I'm not saying you have to purchase it right now, but you can. It's not really a fancy thing to buy a Helmholtz coil that has like three axes, so you can actually know the magnetic field around it. And then once you know the magnetic field, then put the sensor inside the shielding so you can actually really, really minimize the magnetic field around it, so you can make sure that zero is zero and you don't get any noise from those directions. But again,
we actually, we have a set of those in our lab that we use to calibrate our magnetometers that we fly on scientific balloons.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Oh. Can I ask you where that person is?
We're at Dartmouth.
Oh, Dartmouth. Okay, I graduated from Dartmouth. You mean at Krishna Lynch's lab or?
No, this is Robin Millen's lab.
Oh, Robin.
The Bear lab.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. Then, yeah, probably Robin should know much about this.
Oh, yeah, we do that.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
I'm the system engineer on those ones.
So it is going to take between 8 and 10 weeks to get these prototypes made. So it's not like we're running off and needing a home for them right now. Hopefully a lot of this sequestering in place will be over by then, but you know, you really never know, right?
Well, I technically have access to that lab, though I'm trying not to be in there very often, right?
Well, so I guess the question then is really how many do we want to build to cover our initial testing? And that includes testing the board to make sure it works and getting it out to people who have access to these test fixtures that can do some experimentation on them. And assuming that, Hillman, you get access to your lab again, and David, you want to go into your lab.
So I have one technical, so actually we are just simply reading what's coming out of the board, the magnetic sensor. So it's actually a matter of like how to read the number from the magnetometer. I'm asking you.
Okay, you want to clarify that, Dave?
I'm sorry. I was looking for a paper.
Okay, we use I2C, but you want to tell them how we do it?
The reading, I'm going to send Hillman some improved C code. I've given him a link to some very minimal code, but the trouble that just reads using I2C, the registers that are that give the components the of the field vectors, but they have to be read, and they're several bytes each, and they have to be kind of reassembled, bit shifted and whatnot. I have not got a full nice little app that lets you set the number of cycles per measurement, because this thing can average multiple cycles to get, or I don't know what it does precisely. I don't have that. I haven't thought about it just lately, but it can provide different sampling rates and repetitive samples to achieve a higher, a better result. There's several parameters that need to be explored. I think there's more to be determined in terms of what are the best settings than in whether it works or not. I think it does work, but what are the best settings for this purpose really has to be evaluated. So I'm going to try and get Hillman some code that'll do that.
Is that like averaging out the noise, Dave? Is that what it's doing?
I think he wants to average like samples and then report like every, I don't know, 1 second or 10 seconds.
I just don't have the right vocabulary in my head at the moment to explain that, but it's all in the documentation that I can provide.
I have to head up soon, but so would that be okay to maybe build maybe, and it doesn't have to be 10, but 10-ish or 5-ish, and then send out to some people who has like some decent place for testing, like, you know, backyard with no huge traffic around, and then compare the values to each other before actually moving into more serious testing.
Well, I can tell you, I'm out in the country. There's not much around where I'm at. I can certainly test with a minimum of. I'm out in the country, out in rural Alabama. There's very little around here that's going to affect anything. I can certainly do some testing of that kind.
Yeah, that'll be great. Like maybe 5 or 10. I don't know how difficult it is to build like, you know, more sets, but that's my humble proposal. Otherwise, I'm up for anything.
So Nathaniel is the fearless leader of this project. Do you want to be the focal point for kind of collecting how many people can use so we can figure out how many to build?
Let's see. Actually, I think for the magnetometer, that's really more humans. Supposed to be human's job to kind of organize the magnetometer part of the testing, but I can certainly help coordinate that.
Okay, yeah, so if we could just get an idea of where they're going to go so we don't leave anyone out who can help and who wants to help, and just make sure we build enough of them. Because with Dave's work, I'm fairly confident we can make the thing work first out of the gate. It's not a complicated board. Dave's laid the groundwork. Dave's got working boards, so we know how to connect the thing up.
Scotty, keep in mind when you're talking about numbers that for the extender board and for real testing, I think you're talking about two boards for each testing test site.
Right. So for 10 test sites, we need 20 boards, right?
I think we should have a mix of, I think we should try to find a number of sites that have science grade magnetometers already at them. So, of course, Jenny Jump is one of them. David McGaw might be able to connect us with some over near Dartmouth. We could reach out to Terry Bullitt out near Colorado because he's over at essentially like NIST and NOAA. So I think we should definitely try to reach out to some of those people and try and get it near places where there are already some good magnetometers. Then we should also get it into the hands of a few amateurs as well. So we have people on both the amateur side of things and on the more scientific side of things looking at these.
So it seems like we maybe have a use for 20 boards anyway. That would be 10 setups. So it sounds like that might be doable. We'd run the tab up pretty quick.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be good to do like 20 of them. 20. Yeah, so 10 steps you said, but that gives us 20 magnetometers.
Right. So, 10 magnetometers and 20 sets of boards, because half of the boards will be used just as extenders that won't have magnetometers on them, and then the remotes will be outside. Now, if you wanted local ones, the magnetometer right at the Raspberry Pi, then you wouldn't need to have two board sets for those. You just need one board.
Okay, yeah, I think we could definitely use that. 10 stations. And we definitely would want to put a number of them at places that already have good magnetometers. And then, as I said, a few at amateur sites as well. And I think this will do a few things for us. It'll give us some diversity in the testing. It will also, give Bill a source of a data stream source that he can start working with on the database end of things.
Yeah, you can get that going not having even a data engine.
Yeah, and Case Western should have one of these too, because they should, like, the idea was that they would be able to incorporate this magnetometer into their low-cost system as well.
So, hey guys, I have to step out, but I think it's a good idea to build like 10 or 20-ish sets and distribute them to people who have access to good place to test the magnetometer. So I think that's a good idea. Otherwise, I have to step out. Sorry.
Okay, so I think I heard that you said you thought the 20 sets, so 10 sets, 20 boards will be sufficient. Is that right?
Go ahead, Nathaniel.
No, you go ahead, Yeoman. I think it sounds good to me, but you go ahead too.
Yeah, it sounds good to me.
Well, and if we do build, if we do buy 50 blank boards, if we come up short, we can always build more. And although it's on the expensive side to be building them in small quantities, it's doable.
Well, the main cost difference is the board, right?
That and the assembly cost, because if I could get it as automated assembly, the cost comes way down. The parts come down a little bit, but in our case, there's not really that many. So the major components, like you said, are going to be the PC board. And I mean, I've bought PC boards for like under $2 when you buy 1,000. And in fact, this is really humorous. We actually had a PC board shop that quoted us a cheaper price for 1,000 than for 500, if you can believe that.
All right, that's pretty interesting. Some other questions are, how much is this going to cost and who's going to pay for it?
Yeah, that's another question. I'm not quite there yet, but that's one of the reasons I want to do the production version so we can get it nailed down. I think Dave has a pretty good cost of the bomb, but Dave, you're probably buying them in, quantity 1 to 5, right?
Not really, but exclusive of the board, I've been buying the parts in larger quantities, but they aren't a big issue. The boards, well, let's say I bought a lot of them at this point, but I have some that I haven't built up. So we were seen to be overall meeting the objectives for price, but I don't know much about these assembly. The one people I was hoping to maybe get some experience working with an assembly house, but I guess I won't. So I can't speak to that.
Well, if you want some experience with the board house, we can arrange that.
Well, we'll see.
Okay. It's like we're always looking for volunteers. So at any rate, when we get down to the point where we go to a board house and say, how much for 500? Then we get a real good idea of how much it's going to cost. But we really can't do that until we have, you know, the production-ready Gerbers and bombs and everything.
So what's the next step, Scotty, for figuring that out? Is it you just need the rest of the material from David, and then you're able to go price that out?
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do the design in OrCAD, which is our design flow, and then I'm going to give it to the CAD guy and say, okay, now what kind of layout do you need? Can you do this in two layers? Do we need four layers? How cheap can we make the board and still have it work properly? And I'm believing two layers is going to be the way to go, and especially since you probably want a keep out area underneath the magnetometer. So but we'll have to go down that route, and then once we get the Gerbers, then we can get an actual quote from the manufacturer, because we have the file that we need to buy the boards with.
Okay, sounds good.
And I have this entire bomb in DigiKey's, kind of bomb assistant that they like to suck you in with. So I can get a price from DigiKey on the parts pretty easy.
Okay, that's perfect. I have a manufacturing parts person here that at our company that she's amazing. She can go through and when we go to buy for manufacturing, if we end up, we probably won't end up kitting the volume one ourselves, because we'll want to turnkey it over to some manufacturing house that will buy the parts themselves. But on the first production one, we'll be buying, for this prototype production run that's coming up, we'll be buying the parts. And she's an amazing expert in finding the cheapest place to buy parts. So she may, but if she has DigiKey parts, she's happy. She loves working with those part numbers, because everything's online and it's really easy.
Well, I haven't been going for cheap on any of these things. I've just been looking at the number of parts they keep in stock, getting some indication of which ones are high volume parts, and trying to pick, when there's something's in doubt by a little higher, tighter tolerance or something. But overall, I've been trying to keep it rational, but not what an expert might do.
Yeah, and when you're doing, 5 to 10 boards, and maybe buying a little extra on the parts you know you're going to use, like bypass caps, it's a different mindset when you start buying for 500 and above, because then you can shop at different places, because the freight and all that is better. I mean, it's doable. Whereas if you're going to buy $25 worth of parts, you really don't want to split those between three different vendors, because then you're going to pay more in postage and you're going to pay in parts.
You were talking about using zero ohm resistors rather than cuttable traces and things for configuration options, and I decided to buy some zero ohm resistors in three different sizes, and they were so cheap it was crazy to buy anything less than a reel of each. So I have three reels of zero ohm resistors in different sizes, if anyone needs any. 5,000 a reel, I think.
User disconnected from your channel.
Okay. Well, we can buy them from you for the prototypes. I know what you mean. They get so cheap. And the thing about the zero ohm resistors is that the automated pick and place machine can place a zero ohm resistor, but it can't place a solder bridge. So and it can't cut traces. So that's kind of where we go from for that. So it may seem like a waste, putting a lot of extra resistors on to complete traces that you could just trace through. But in manufacturing, you can't cut traces. That's something that you put in for the user to do later if he wants to mod the board.
Well, it was more nuisance than it was worth. So I used the PCB pads to do it. But I do think there are some other subjects here that folks would like to discuss, and we've kind of sucked up a lot of time just on this. I hope we've covered it.
Yeah, I think we have. Thanks. I see that Rob has gone. I wanted to talk to him a little bit with him and Bill about the database that he's building and see if there's any way to make them compatible. So, Bill, do you know what Rob is storing, what kind of data he's storing in his KPH database?
I'm sorry. You're talking about the guy from Case Western Reserve? I zoned out a little bit.
No, Rob, AI6 VH, I think his call is. Rob Robinette from KPH over in California.
No, I do not know what he's storing. The chance that he's going to be storing the same thing that we are is close to zero, because the only thing we're going to be using a database for is storing account information, such as people who are going to be personal space weather station users. They'll get on the database and get an account, and we store that sort of thing in the database. Then the database will have a cross-reference of data. Now, if you're talking about a collection of spectrum information and you're calling that a database, we just call that data rather than database. It's not stored in any relational format, but rather in a hierarchical series of just files. And those are going to be, well, there's various flavors of them, but I guess in short terms, I'm not familiar with what he's storing or planning to store. So that's a long-winded explanation to just say that.
Yeah,
Bill? Oh, sorry, Tom.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think Rob's been storing whisper spots in an influx-like database, basically time series. And he's had some issues storing lots and lots and lots and lots of spots. So as Bill said, I think it's kind of a different problem than what Bill is looking at.
User disconnected from your channel. I'm with you now. Spots. Well, I'm dealing with two different kinds of data. Yeah, I've got spots. I've got billions of spots collected through PSK, through the cluster, through Whisper, and through Reverse Beacon Network. That's kind of separate from the data that we're planning to store through the personal space weather station. Yeah, we're still looking at a way to store. I don't think we're going to end up storing that stuff in a database, because it's big data. It's too big to go into a conventional database. Right now, we're thinking about storing it simply as a collection of files that's in a rationally laid out directory structure, laid out in a directory structure, so that you can vector into the date range that you want to look at and extract the data that you want to look at, but extract it as files, which then you have to go through and count things. With spots, it's an analytics thing. It's you're counting the number of spots various ways, like on what frequency and what time frame, through what, maybe looking at different lat long areas. Yeah, that is, if I had my way, I would get funding and do that using Amazon Web Services and Hadoop, just like, and do it the same way that Google does it. But I don't know if we're going to get that kind of funding.
Well, I just wanted to make sure that we could make something that was compatible, because it seems like he's going to have a bunch of data to store and we're going to have a bunch of data to store. And I don't know how he's doing it, but if Dave says he's doing it in a database, it's like maybe a little different than we're doing it. But it might be good to have a meeting of the minds and try to figure out something that, even if he stores it differently, at least it might be compatible with us, so that if his users want to get a personal space weather station account and add their own data to it in their format with their own timestamps and their own metadata, that we would at least not prevent them from doing that.
Well, here's something to be aware of. The data that we're going to be collecting using the personal space weather station, is not spots. The stuff that is collected through PSK Reporter, Reverse Beacon Network, the DX Cluster, and WhisperNet, those are spots, and that is completely different from any kind of spectrum data. The spots are just, okay, we have information that a signal went from this point to that point at a, on a certain frequency and a certain date. We don't know anything about the detailed characteristics of it other than it was heard on a certain frequency. Whereas with the personal space weather station data, there's a tendency for us to be looking at some of the details of the signal itself, like what did the spectrum look like at that point. So it's really, it's very much a different problem.
Well, I get the difference between spots and spectrum data, but it wasn't clear what exactly Rob was storing. So now if Dave is clear that he's only storing spots, then that's fine. But he has arrays of Kiwi SDRs, so there's no reason why he couldn't store data, spectrum data also. And, you know, maybe more limited than what we're going to have to store, but maybe still useful nonetheless.
Well, all I can say is we're going to do the best we can to figure out what to store that's in a, in a way, stored in such a way as to make it as most useful as we can to the most people. And we, all that's going to be made public. So if somebody else wants to store something in a similar kind of way, or wants to give us information on what they're storing so we can make it one of the options, I'm certainly open to that.
Okay, great. That's all we can do, I guess. And we are open source, so, you know, they follow it or not, you know, depending on what you want.
Yeah, and on speaking about storing of data, I just wanted to have a little bit of a short follow-up on our discussion from last week. When storing data coming from the personal space weather station, and particularly talking about ring buffer data at this point, we have the ability to store 1 through 16 channels. And I just want to throw this out there. Due to the way digital RF works, if we're going to store multiple channels, which I certainly would like to do that, store multiple subchannels into a single file. For example, you'd like to collect data at 2.5 megahertz and then 5 and 10, 15, 20, and 25, and you know, keep all that data so you can look at the Doppler shift and look at the amount of signal at each location and things like that. All those channels will be collected at the same data rate. That is a requirement for digital RF. So the second item is we talked a little bit on how to figure out the number of samples, and we talked about it being a power of 2 or being divisible into 1024 or something. Let me suggest this. Because there are several options where somebody might want to store an odd number of channels that doesn't divide evenly into 1024. What I think will work very well for this is if we do the following. We take 1024 and divide that by the number of channels the person wants to store, and just take the integer of that. In other words, throw away the remainder, and that will be the number of samples we'll store in that buffer. So if you take 1024 and divide it by 5, for example, you get 204, for example. So there would be 204 samples of 5 channels in each 1024 buffer. And that makes it very easy to deal with on both the data engine side and in storing into digital RF. What do you think, Scotty?
Yeah, so if you wanted to store 1024 channels, then they'd each get one sample apiece. I mean, I'm being ridiculous here, but yeah, I think that that works perfectly well. And then you don't have any. So then the packets will be different lengths, right? Because that may end up being like 1021 bytes or something, right?
Well,
1021 samples.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in the case of, as I was talking about earlier, 204, if you're collecting 5 channels, that would be 204, and they're 8 bytes apiece. So you'd end up with you know, the 1632 rather than, well, let me see. They are not, how many bytes, we're dealing with, well, that'd be not times five. So it would be 8,160 bytes rather than the power of two. I mean, it'd be slightly shorter. You see what I'm saying?
Right. So you just reduce the number of samples until an even number of interleaves fits in your 1024 sample or less, so that you always get so you don't overflow the packet. So the packet is always 1024 samples or less.
Yeah, what you should be cautious here. Remember, an Ethernet frame maximum size limit is 1,500 bytes.
Right, and I think we're going to make that actually 1024 plus headers, so we're going to easily stay under that, right, Bill?
Yes, that's not 1024 samples. That's 1024 bytes.
Go ahead, Bill.
Our buffers are always going to be 8,192 bytes or so, slightly less.
So a jumbo frame then.
Yeah, we've been talking about this. We've been saying this from the beginning that we were going to use, we were going to have 1024, like consider a single sample, 1024, but they're 8 bytes apiece because it's I and Q, each 4 bytes, so that's 8 times 1024.
Right, so 8192 bytes, 1024 samples.
Right, and that's the case for if you're going to be collecting one channel. So it's always going to be something that's less than 8192, and that doesn't include the header. There will be a header, which I'm still trying to figure out the exact content of, but it'll, you know, some little bit of a header that contains things like the time stamp that you want to put on it and the number of channels and some details about a few things and maybe the magnetometer reading at that moment, something like that.
Yeah, so you might want, so that would be between the data engine and the local host. You may want to check all of your Ethernet parts to make sure they support jumbo frames.
Yeah, I believe the tri-port switch does, but good idea to check it.
Yeah, well, yeah, the Raspberry Pi would need to as well. You know, anything, the interface on the local host, all the parts in that chain would have to support jumbo frames.
Yeah, and isn't the Ethernet part in the Raspberry Pi, is that built onto the chip, or is that a separate part?
I do not know.
Well, I don't know about the Raspberry Pi, but I've been doing my simulations running 1024 samples, and it runs like gangbusters on the Odroid. Now, of course, I'm not using the same switch. I'm using just a commercial gigabit switch that I bought to go between between the Odroid that's simulating the data engine and the Odroid that's simulating the SBC.
Okay, so from the web, the LAN IC on the Raspberry Pi 3B Plus does support jumbo frames. The Raspberry Pi 4 internal gigabit Mac does support jumbo frames, but their driver does not.
So that's interesting. So that means the Odroid driver does.
Yeah, or else the information about the Raspberry Pi 4 is stale or out of date. At any rate, I suggest if you're planning on jumbo frames, you need to call that out specifically and test it first.
Here you go. Jumbo packet support up to 9,000 bytes in the tri-speed switch, tri-port switch.
Okay, so at least if you've tested it with the Odroid, that's good. Raspberry Pi 4, you know, supports it in hardware, and the drivers, as of the date of this note, may not support it, but maybe they do now. It's a good question.
That is a good thing to bring up.
Yeah, the three-port switch on the DE will support it, so we've got everything but the Pi 4 covered.
Well, what that kind of reminds me, earlier, Dan, N4XWE, I don't know if you're still in there, if you're still listening, I see you're on the list. You had mentioned that you were looking at a couple of other small board computers. I would like to know what those are. I wish you'd send me an email with some of those, because what I'd like to do is I'd like to get a sample of each one of them and test them with the stuff that I'm developing to see if any gremlins come out of the woodwork kind of early on.
Okay, Bill, I can do that.
That would be great.
Can you send that stuff to the list so we can all check it out? You know me and the single board computer junkie habit.
Excellent sure. idea.
Yeah, I can do that. Not a problem.
Thank you.
Scotty, it's been a good talk, but we're starting to be over time.
Yes, that we are, but it has been great. So I guess I'm okay here. Anybody else have anything? Did you get what you needed, Bill?
Yes, it's good. It's good to proceed with. I will do a little bit more testing, and I might see what happens and put my result out to the mailing list. I think that would give people a chance to think about it and comment.
And you know, a lot of us have Odroids, so it would be fun to get more than one setup running.
Well, yeah, I mean. I'm struggling with one of the things I've got to say. In order to get this thing working, there is an awful lot of prerequisites that you have to install on the Odroid. This can be interesting rolling this out to a large community of users because it's well. Hopefully, we can simplify things down a little bit. But this is one of the things that I need to add to the GitHub thing. A list of all of the prerequisites that have to be installed on the Odroid in order to make the software work, because it's a lot of them.
Okay, well, Nathaniel may know this. Who was the guy working with Christina at Case that was the expert on package types? And I think he was volunteering to do that job.
Rob Weisler. Yeah, Weisler.
Yeah, so maybe engage him again and see if he would be interested in still doing it.
We will definitely be involving him. Yes, absolutely.
Scotty, do you want to touch base before next Monday night regarding the plan for the magnetometer ordering? Or are we good until next Monday?
Well, Dave's going to send me the stuff that he has. I think we're good until next Monday. And I can get on the list if I need info in the meantime, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Did you want to spend a minute or two on lectures, or you want to do that after we're done here?
Either way, we can let other people go, and then we can talk about it.
I have one quick question for Nathaniel.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
This model you have requires a height, and I'm used to... terrestrial heights, it's in kilometers. In the lowest kilometers, 100 kilometers up. Is that really a valid number for comparing against something that's sitting on my desk?
Yeah, I think try putting in 0 kilometers. Can you do that?
Oh, okay. Yes, you can.
Yeah, because a lot of the times this model is really used for measurements that either are on spacecraft or are somewhere out in space. But for ground magnetometers, I think you can just put in 0 kilometers, and that should be good enough.
Yeah, I saw height, and I first off assumed it was meters, and then I noticed, hey, it's kilometers.
Yeah, those are very large meters.
Thanks.
No problem. You do have to be careful with these units. When I was in Svalbard, spending a semester over there, I was with some friends and we had some snowmobiles, and they said, let's see, we were driving for a really long time, and I was like, and they're like, oh, we just went, 6 miles. I'm like, what do you mean? We've been driving, quite fast for, many hours now. And it turned out that a Norwegian mile is equal to 10 kilometers.
Oh, yes.
I never knew that before. That's cool.
Yeah, so if you go to Norway and you talk to a Norwegian and they say, oh, it's just a couple miles up the road, you better clarify.
Wow, so 1 mile is 10 clicks?
That's right.
Now that's something you can dazzle people with.
You bet.
Is that true in Norway?
They have a foot race called the Spitsbergen Mile, and it's really a 10K.
Oh, interesting. Luckily, so I never dealt with it. I just saw kilometers and didn't get confused.
Is that true just in Norway or in Scandinavia in general?
I don't know about Scandinavia in general. They'd probably understand. Definitely Norway, but maybe the rest too.
I'm going to email
I would think they would understand because they have a number of unique unit measures.
Yeah, here on Wikipedia, they talk about the Scandinavian mile. And yeah, it says 1 mile is 10 kilometers.
Yeah, there's also a Danish inch, which is slightly different than the English / American inch.
But probably not like 6x difference.
No, and unfortunately, it's pretty close, just enough to really hose you up.